It's Lake Effect on 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee Public Radio. Good morning, I'm Mitch Tyke. We spoke with journalist Paul Tough a couple of years ago when he came to Milwaukee in support of his book, How Children Succeed. In that book, the education writer profiled several remarkable people and their work in helping kids do their best work, fostering traits like grit and determination. Tough found scenes from a teacher who developed a powerhouse chess team in a low-income neighborhood, to a high-performing private school in New York City, to a pediatric clinic in San Francisco, all as he searched for what it is that allows some kids to succeed. But even after that work, Tough believed part of the equation was still missing. He tries to fill in that gap with his latest book, Helping Children Succeed, and Paul Tough joins us this morning via Skype from New York to explain what he found. Welcome back to the show.
Thank you. Great to be here.
How did you see this book, Helping Children Succeed, relating to your last one? It seems like a fairly obvious follow-up. Do you feel like it was almost like an addendum?
Maybe a sequel would be a better word. So How Children Succeed was really a work of narrative nonfiction. So I was exploring this idea of these non-cognitive skills or character strengths, things like grit, curiosity, and conscientiousness, and how important they are in the lives of children. But what I didn't do, and I think partly because of the way narrative nonfiction works, it's mostly a storytelling genre, is I didn't provide a lot of answers to people who are working directly with kids, trying to help them succeed, to the question, now that we know this, what do we do? So this new book, Helping Children Succeed, is my attempt to answer that question and to give people working with kids, especially kids who are growing up in poverty and other forms of adversity, some real strategies and solutions that they can use to help kids succeed.
You make this point kind of early on that that people find something, some small gem that works, and instantly they try to scale it up and make it apply to everyone who's going through challenges. But you make the point that scaling up does not necessarily work with education the way it does with, say, technology. Why is that?
It's a great question. I think it's a mystery to a lot of people who are in this field. And I think it's something that, you know, philanthropists struggle with, but it's also something I think the journalists struggle with. And so when I look back at my last couple of books, one of the things that I did, you know, explicitly or implicitly, was write about specific programs with the idea that, you know, if I find the perfect program that's going to help every kid, all we have to do is replicate that in every city and every school across the country, and all of our problems will be solved. And I think partly the reality is that this process of trying to help kids do better is complicated and personal, and it exists. You know, it's not something that can be mass produced the way technological goods can. And so, what I'm trying to do in this new book is instead of saying here's who to copy, I'm saying here are the principles that seem like they are at work in the both in the science and in the programs that I think seem most promising. And my hope is that educators or parents or policymakers or anyone else can take from that distillation of those principles some ideas on how to change and improve their own work.
What we don't need is 10,000 chess clubs around the country necessarily.
Exactly. Yeah. I mean, you know, I'm all for chess clubs. But exactly. It's not just that, you know, it's a process where you look at what's working and try and copy that perfectly. Each educator, each program, each kid is different and is unique, and so we need good strategies for each one of them.
The things that you describe as character skills, you know, grit, determination, resilience, they get a lot of attention. What has been wrong in our approach to this point in trying to harness these skills?
The problem is that we have been thinking about them as skills. So the word that, you know, a lot of that I use and that other people in this realm use is non-cognitive skills. And when you hear the word skills, you think of something that you can learn, like riding a bike or learning how to read or learning how to swim, learning how to do math. And you think of it as something you learn through sort of practice and repetition. You can have, you know, worksheets and homework. And that the reality is that these qualities are not the same kind of thing as those skills. They are much more like psychological mindsets. And as a result, there's something that is mostly affected by the environment in which children find themselves, both at home and at school. So most of the strategies that I write about in Helping Children Succeed are about how to change the environment that kids are growing up in, rather than how to drill them on specific skills to help them do better.
Well, and changing the environment in school is one thing, but changing the environment outside of school, especially at home, is something completely different and fairly hard, but I gather not impossible to get at with policy.
Yeah, I mean, arguably the environment at home, especially in the first few years of life, is the most important force in the development of children. And you're right, I think in the past we have thought that there wasn't much that that society, the policymakers, the philanthropists could do to affect what happened. That seemed like a private realm that wasn't anyone else's business. And in fact, there are a number of great interventions that I read about in this book that, you know, don't intrude on that private realm, don't, you know, lecture parents about what to do, but instead give them the kind of support and help and encouragement that every parent wants and needs. And that when that is done in a sort of sensitive and effective way, mostly through home visitors, the evidence suggests that that this can have a really transformative effect on the way that parents behave, the way they think about themselves as parents, and that that effect then, that change then has a big effect on how kids do, starting in infancy. And we can see its effects on children's behavior, on their physical health. We can even see its effects on their, like the levels of cortisol and other stress hormones in their bloodstreams, all because of an intervention that works directly with the parents.
Why is play with parents so vital?
Well, what psychologists and neuroscientists are finding now is that one of the most important activities in a child, and especially in infant's development, is what they call serve and return interactions. And it's just these little face-to-face, down on the living room rug moments between parents and children, where the baby makes what they call a serve, and that can be anything from a little vocalization to a cry to you know, just indicating something, pointing at something, or holding something up. And when the parent responds and says, oh, yeah, look at your toy, or you see the fan, or something like that, all those, you know, ridiculous little things that we parents do all the time with our babies, that actually has this profound effect on the development of children's brains and infants' brains. They're learning these incredibly important lessons about how the world works and what their place is in it, and most importantly, what their relationship is with this giant being who's always around, their parent. And when those interactions happen in this warm, responsive, serve and return way, it is incredibly profound and powerful for a child's development, not just in terms of their cognitive development, but also in this non-cognitive psychological realm.
Does all this stuff have to happen within the realm of a house, or is there something to be said for some of this playing out in kind of early childhood education settings?
I think it can be both. So parents are, I think, the most important teacher, the most important tool that we have to help children succeed in those early years. But it goes without saying that infants, children aren't with their parents all the time. And so some of the interventions that I read about in helping children succeed are trying to figure out other moments in early childhood and then in K-12 education where we can improve environments and help kids do better. So that includes, you know, pre-K programs. It includes programs like EduCare, which is this really high-quality early childhood program for kids in poverty in 27 cities across the country. And it also includes programs like there's one I read about called All Our Kin in Connecticut that works with unlicensed informal child care providers, which is where a lot of low-income kids spend their days, you know, in the home of the neighbor down the street who just takes a few kids in every day. Sometimes those settings are really not so helpful, not so conducive to the development of these skills in kids. But this program, All Our Kin, works directly with those informal providers to improve the atmosphere, the environment in those informal centers in a way that helps those infants and children develop.
You mentioned all these various phases of education, from early childhood education all the way through, you know, K-12. And I think you make the point that maybe we're hamstringing our efforts to do something by necessarily dividing childhood and education into these discrete phases.
Yeah, this is really something I think that persists in our thinking about childhood, certainly in the bureaucracies that we use to try to help kids, and even I think just in the way we think about childhood. We think that there's something different about early childhood. But the reality is that's not the way that children experience childhood. They experience it as a continuum. And that's true for parents as well. Families think of this as one unbroken developmental process. And if our policies were reflecting that, I think we would do a much better job of coordinating interventions to help kids do better all the way through their childhood.
Another thing that really strikes me, and you write about this as well, is that many of the people that you met and watched who did the best at ingraining these skills, or whatever we're calling them, were the ones who did it without necessarily explicitly talking about it. You know, their kids were getting resilience and grit and so forth without these necessarily seeming like lessons in resilience or grit or so forth. So what do we know about how the messaging plays out?
There were certain educators who were very explicit about, we got to teach grit, we got to teach self-control. And then there were others who, like I mentioned, this chess coach, Elizabeth Spiegel, at a middle school in New York City, who was doing this fantastic job of helping her students in this non-cognitive realm. Her kids, you know, who were mostly low-income minority students, had this amazing amount of grit and perseverance. They would sit at the chessboard for hours on end. They would, work tremendously hard. They would bounce back from disappointment. They got along, you know, they just had all of these qualities, and yet she never talked about character or grit or self-control or anything else. All she talked about was chess. And what that suggested to me, and then where it led me in this new book, was this understanding that the way that kids develop these skills is not through someone lecturing them about those skills. It's through being in an environment where they feel a sense of belonging, a sense of competence, and a sense of growth, where they can see themselves getting better at something by persevering through failure. And chess is a tremendous way to learn those skills, especially in the hands of a really talented coach and teacher like Elizabeth Spiegel. But there are ways that I think the most promising schools do that in the classroom all the time, where they've found ways to turn math class and history class and social science class into opportunities for kids to experience that growth, not just by doing, you know, repetitive worksheets, but by taking on hard and challenging projects where they can, you know, not only learn academic content, but also these non-cognitive qualities.
It's hard to get past the thought that many of the people who read this book or hear this interview will be people for whom this is kind of intellectual exercise. You know, their kids might go to pretty good schools. They might come from a pretty stimulating home environment. What do you hope people at large, I guess, if you will, what do you hope they take from this book and what do you hope they do with it?
Well, I guess a couple of things. So I think on the first page of the book, I talk about the statistic that I encountered in my reporting that was really surprising to me, even if it shouldn't have been, which is that a couple of years ago, we, for the first time as a nation, passed this this kind of landmark point where, for the first time, more than 50% of students in American public schools were eligible for a free and reduced price lunch, meaning that they are considered low income by the government's definition. And for me, it's this indication that the struggles and the challenges of kids who are growing up in poverty to succeed in school is no longer something we can think about as sort of a side issue in education. It is really the main event. And so my hope, first of all, is that this is something that citizens at large, whether they're low income or high income, can think this is a national project that we need to get behind and get involved in. And there's lots that we as a nation can do. But that said, I also feel like there is something that, well-off parents can take from this book in terms of how they think about their own kids. So I have a one-year-old and a six-year-old, and as I wrote this book, the one-year-old was born. The six-year-old started kindergarten; he's now finishing first grade. And so I've had the experience, both as a parent of an infant and as a parent of a public school student. Thinking about how these questions of belonging and possibility and growth and challenge play out both at home and at school. And it's been profound the way that this research has affected my thinking as a parent as well.
And for people who work explicitly, whether they're teachers or advocates in some way for kids in disadvantaged neighborhoods, would you hope that they advocate for something a little bit different?
To my mind, this research about the impact of stress on children's development, about the importance of the environment in developing these psychological non-cognitive qualities, this is relevant no matter what you're doing. If you're interacting with low-income kids, if you're a teacher, if you're a principal, if you are a benefactor helping to run a program, to my mind, this should inform the way that those programs are run. And so my hope is that, this will start a conversation for some significant change in terms of how we run those programs.
Well, Paul Tough, as with the last book, really thought-provoking stuff. Thank you so much.
Thanks very much.
Education writer Paul Tough's latest book is called Helping Children Succeed, What Works and Why. He joined us via Skype from New York.